And we're back, ladies and gentlemen, here on the Ross Report. Thanks again for downloading us and telling your friends about our show. Good show today. I just got a great feeling because we're going to take you all the way to Calgary, Alberta, Canada. My friend Lance Storm is here. Citizen Storm, how are you today, sir?
I'm doing fantastic, sir.
Good deal. Good deal. I've been anxious to talk with you. I hear your commentaries with Brian Alvarez on Figure 4. Enjoy them. Enjoy your point of view and your perspective, because it's funny how much sense a guy can make when he just uses logic.
Yes, when you... I think it comes from, again, just a respect for the business and wanting to take pride in what I did during it and take pride in the product when I watch it. I think I value a lot of the same things in the industry as you do.
Yeah, I think so. I agree. Hey, I am so, you know, I used to do some commentary down at NXT. We were talking about when Emma, the Australian young lady who's now on got called up the main roster, and Tyler Breeze, who is doing very well at NXT, and I'm sure very soon he'll be on WWE's main roster. Both of them are graduates of the Storm Wrestling Academy in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. And I know that you have a class in session now. Tell us what makes your school, your academy, different than other wrestling schools that people, you know, research. Because when I get a tweet or an email or something, I say, what wrestling school should I go to? I don't tell them conclusively where they should or shouldn't go. I said, well, here's what I would suggest. If I were you, I'd check out thoroughly the Storm Wrestling Academy in Calgary at the top of my list. I'd check it off before I would move any farther. So what makes yours different, Lance? I guess is what I'm saying.
I appreciate that, Jared. I think a few things. First and foremost is my name's on the door, and I'm the guy that's in the ring with you. And I think it's important to be taught by someone who has been where you want to go and is generally respected as someone who knew what he was doing while he was there. And then I think, too, someone with a good reputation as far as someone you can trust is going to treat you well and treat your kids well. So in addition to being in the ring with my students, I have matches with my students. I'm hands-on every single day. I think one thing, and I didn't necessarily make a conscious effort of this, but it just transpired that way, if you will, and I get a lot of great feedback from students, is that it turns out that in addition to teaching them wrestling, I do teach a lot of life lessons. You know, I cover the potential pitfalls of, you know, drugs, fame, financial troubles, trying to deal with the industry in a smart fashion so that you get out with your body intact, your mind intact, hopefully your bank account, and if you're fortunate enough to find a significant other, get out of the industry with your relationship still intact.
Yeah, well, that's so important. And that's what I tell people. When I say, well, what makes Lance's school so important? I say, well, if he teaches you the same life lessons and the same values that he always had, then you're going to be a better person, if whether you make it in pro wrestling or you don't. So I really respect that, because it's not all about their tuition and all that stuff. It's about learning some life lessons, learning a very unique skill in pro wrestling, and learning to do it the right way, safety, fundamentally sound, all those things. And now your class is how many weeks?
12 weeks. I do 3 12-week sessions per year, and we train Monday through Friday.
Wow. How the kids normally, what do they do, Lance, on housing? I know it's up to them, but what's some of the, is it hard for a kid, if there's somebody's listening to this that wants to be a wrestler, and they decide to go to your website, which is?
Stormwrestling.com.
Stormwrestling.com, and check out your school. How do they, because that would be a question I would think of, what do I do about housing? What do we do? How does that work?
There's actually a few options. The first and foremost is I own a second home that I rent rooms to students in. I started that, I think, a year after I started my school, because I was surprised how many international students I had apply.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've had students now from about 13 different countries.
Golly, that's great.
And yeah, so there's 5 rooms in the student house that book up fairly quickly. And then over the course of time, I've found four or five other ladies in town that have basement suites, rent out extra rooms. So once the student housing is full, I pass on the contact information. And with the other contacts I have in town, there's probably room for another, you know, eight or nine students as well. And then some students just grab the bull by the horn. They go online and they, you know, find a room, they find an apartment. I think the most go-to-it guy, I had a guy from England, his name was Rory, and I picked him up at the airport, and he had just booked a youth hostel downtown for a day, and I dropped him off on Friday, and by Monday morning, he had his own apartment and a job.
Wow.
And
that's ambitious.
He was ambitious, and he worked hard, and that pays off.
So the classes are Monday through Friday from what time?
I run a three-hour session, approximately. I go 10 a.m. till 1 p.m. It gives me time to drop my daughter off at school, teach, hit the gym, and then pick her up after school. So it makes for a good life for me.
That's good. That's smart. That's a really a good deal. So, well, a lot of the things we're going to talk about today, kind of we're going to go back to your philosophy of how you have organized, structured your school. Anybody that's listening, you know, I can't tell you, you know, Lance was a pleasure to work with in WWE when he came there. It was never an issue, never, ever. No drugs, no alcohol issues, never late. Everything was great. So if you go to his school, you're going to learn how to work. You're going to learn how to do the fundamentals, and you're going to learn some life lessons that where you leave a better man or woman than you got there. So stormwrestling.com has all your info, and I would highly, highly recommend that you check it out. And also, another nice thing, if you're listening internationally, i.e. outside the USA, getting into Calgary as a foreigner, is easier than getting into the United States, I would think, right?
Yeah, it is, especially for European countries, England in particular, obviously, and Australia and so forth. We've got the Commonwealth connection that it's actually quite easy. As long as you're not planning on getting a full-time regular job while you're here,
right?
Pretty much every country is minimum of 90 days on a visitor's visa, which is within our 12-week period. You can get in and out in less than 90 days. So you don't need any kind of visa work unless you're planning on getting a regular job. Then that's a little more complicated. But, again, I've had students from as far away as Australia, Emma being one of them, and I think about 13 countries now. So it's a job that you'll have to travel once you get. So sometimes it's worth the trip to get the training you need.
Yeah, I agree. Well, here's the way I look at it is that there's a couple of things. It's a great school. It's a great teaching environment taught by a guy that has character and integrity, who's not going to fleece you. And the second thing is that you've already attracted the interest of WWE because they've signed some of your kids. So if I'm thinking I'm a civilian, so to speak, and I'm looking to get in the wrestling business, they got to consider your place, and it just makes common sense for a lot of reasons, especially if you're, and we have a big audience in the UK, we have a big audience in Australia. Did you break in Calgary?
I did. I went to the Hart Brothers Pro Wrestling Camp in 1990 with Chris Jericho.
So you and Chris went to the same school at the same time?
Yep. We met two or three days before class started and have been friends ever since.
That's great. When you went to Smoky Mountain, was that your first territory?
Not really, because I had worked the CWA catch territory for Otto Vons
okay.
In 93, but it was my first real territory in North America, yeah.
One step back. When you were going to the Hart Brothers school in 1990, who were the primary instructors?
The primary instructor was a kid named Brad Young, who I think was a graduate the year or two before me.
Hmm.
Keith Hart was the Hart in charge, and he was there for a few of the days, but not many of them. He had an older guy named Ed Langley who opened the doors up and ran and organized the classes, but Brad Young was the kid that demonstrated and was the one that actually showed us how to execute and do all the holds.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was, again, run the same format as I have as far as Monday through Friday, but they only ran 8 weeks. It was in, learn a bit, and get out.
Yeah. When you went to work in Smoky Mountain, who facilitated you getting with Jim Cornette and getting booked there?
I sent him a tape, basically. That's one thing that, that Chris and I were really big on when we broke in. We sent pictures and tapes to everybody. And when I had heard Smoky Mountain was, you know, a territory that was doing a few things, I sent a videotape and 8x10 pictures just with no idea if you're to the point where you would bring in talent from other places, but if you are, I'd be very interested in working for you. Thank you very much. Here's my stuff.
Right.
And I found out afterwards that Jimmy used to get lots of stuff sent to him, so it was several months before he watched my tape and liked it, because I guess he had had the thrill seeker gimmick in his head for a while and was looking for the right athletic, exciting young kids to put in it.
Mm-hmm.
And saw my tape, found my phone number, called it. My number had been changed because I had moved and it was no longer in service, and he's like, well, hell. And I got lucky that most of the wrestling on the tape was for a local promotion in Calgary named Canadian Rocky Mountain Wrestling. And there was a kid wrestling as PJ Walker, just incredible.
Yeah.
Who was taking bumps back in the squash match format days of WWE, and he had a Canadian Rocky Mountain Wrestling jacket because Justin was trained in Calgary, and the year Justin came to the Hart Brothers camp, I was the former graduate that was teaching. So I trained Justin Credible, and when Jim Cornette saw his jacket, he said, do you know the kid Lance Storm? And PJ was, yeah, I know him. He trained me. And he got me Jim Cornette's number, and I called Jimmy up, and off to Smoky Mountain I was.
Yeah, it was a, I did a little time there, and, you know, between WWE gigs, which I'm noted for. I hope that's not my legacy, but nonetheless, Corny really worked hard to make that territory viable, you know, doing a little bit of everything and enlisting the help of all kinds of people. It's funny how the people gravitate to a local promotion, and you can draft people to do a little media or do a little promotion or be on the ring crew or a referee or a ring announce or whatever it may be. But I really wanted him to make that thing work, and I can say this, he sure gave it a great effort all along. It's just so hard. You know, it's just, I see these major companies struggling. And so the small territories, golly, it's even more challenging. But he did some good shows, and I got to work some broadcasts that they take for their DVDs and stuff, where I had a great time. He booked some really good wrestling shows.
He did, and it was such a learning experience for me because it really was my first territory. All the groups in Calgary and Manitoba and all the places in Canada I had worked were, we'd really just come in, maybe do a TV taping or just do some spot shows, but Smoky Mountain was the first territory where I got to feel what that was like and learn from some really good people. You know, Tracy Smothers was way more experienced than me, the Rock and Roll Express, and obviously Jim Cornette as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really great. And, you know, when you talk about some of the great programs, it wasn't that long ago I watched the Night of Legends show, which I think was the first time you had come in. And there was a main event. It was a six-man. It had, you know, Terry Funk, Dory Funk, Road Warrior Hawk, Bullet Bob Armstrong, Tracy Smothers. And on the DVD, there's about a 20-minute video package showing the build-up for this main event match that was built up over about 6 or 8 months. And it was so intriguing. It made so much sense. And I think we put about 5,000 people in that building for that show.
Yeah, I did well. That was in Knoxville, right?
It was in Knoxville.
Yeah. Yeah, I worked with Les Thatcher, I think, on that show.
Yes.
And that was first time with Les. But, hey, Corny did a little bit. He was ubiquitous. He was everywhere. And he had his little minions and his crew doing all this stuff, and he brought in some good talent. And, you know, like a lot of good bookers, and there aren't any bookers anymore. Anybody that thinks there's no bookers in wrestling, not in the WWE Impact or Ring of Honor. They're not bookers, at least in my view. But Corny was an old-school booker in that he would have this basic idea, and then he would get the talent together, and the talent would contribute to their creative and help lay out their own match because they knew what they could do best. They knew what they didn't do well. And the mark of a great booker has always been to identify the strengths of your talent and embellish it, and to also identify your talent's weaknesses and hide them. And so Corny was really good about getting the talent in a little circle and, okay, here's what I like. I like, you know, I'd like to get 20 minutes out of this, and I want so-and-so to go over, and, you guys talk about it, and let's see what we come up with later on, whatever. But that's how Bill Watts booked a lot. He would know what he wanted to do from a big picture standpoint, but he would let the talents have a lot of input on the details. Or in other words, how do I get to this destination? When the talents would help you come up, like they were the GPS. Worked out pretty good. And Corny reminded me of that. Did you feel that when you guys were working in tags, you and Chris, where you got a chance to add to your match, to book your own match as far as the bell-to-bell stuff was concerned?
Just a little bit. We were pretty green then, so Jim gave us a fair bit of direction. And when we worked with the Heavenly Bodies, they obviously contributed a real bulk of it.
Yeah.
But I think what I got with Jimmy, because it was really the first chance to do, you know, long angles, because we were running a territory and we were there for a while, it was, you know, discovering the idea of booking an angle, in that, you know, Jimmy came to us and it's like, at Night of Legends, it's going to be you guys and the Heavenly Bodies. That's 2 months away. Right now you're here, they're here. We need to find out how we get you to collide at that date.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really creating that angle so those 2 points intersect on that show.
Yep.
And, you know, it started with putting Jim Cornette's cake in face in a cake. Classic wrestling.
Yep.
That worked.
I've seen that, by the way.
It went from there. And even with, and I was a dreadful, dreadful promo guy back then. Jericho was tolerable and I was atrocious. But, you know, Jimmy helped with that. You know, this is what happened. This is where we're going to be. What do you have to say about it? And he didn't just tell us what to say. He, you know, told us what we were trying to sell, gave us some motivation for it, and tried to get us to express ourselves. I needed a lot of work, but at the time, Jimmy helped.
You didn't have a script. He gave you bullet points and encouragement and direction, and then allowed your own creativity and skill, whatever level that skill was, to be exposed. And I believe that your promos, and I don't remember hearing them, but I bet you the promos were at least real. They're believable because you weren't playing an actor, or you weren't being an actor. You were trying to make these valid, sellable points, which is why I'm a major advocate of bullet-pointed promos and not, here's your copy, go memorize your lines, and then later tonight you're going to do a one-take promo in front of a live audience as if you were a trained Shakespearean actor. It's a system built for failure, in my view.
Well, I think there's a reason actors go to acting school and spend 20 years becoming good actors. It's not that easy.
Nope.
And I think if you allow, I always call it coming into your own and finding yourself. When you discover who you really are as a performer, then you don't need to act anymore. You're in that situation. The Heavenly Bodies beat me up in a parking lot. That made me mad, and I'm going to give them a piece of my mind.
Sure.
And I need to know that it's Night of Legends. I need to know that it's August whatever. But that's all I need. And if I can speak from my heart, then the fans are going to hopefully feel that and attach to it.
Well, they know they're not being worked. They know that you're not reciting something from some writer who's trying to channel your emotions and put it in his keyboard and then print off the script and hand it to you. To me, that's very sterile. It's very unreality-based. It's just not, again, I just think it's a system that's not built for the long-haul success. You know, you talked about this angle you guys had, and I'm sure you have more than one storyline that went long, because bookers always try to find something that had legs. I mean, that was smart. If the Heavenly Bodies and the Thrill Seekers had chemistry, well, then the last thing the booker wanted to do was to have that chemistry implode and move on to something else before it had, quote-unquote, ran its course. And the smart bookers, and the smart talents for that matter, always knew when things were peaking. So we could leave this thing with a little bit of momentum, because somebody's going to go over and move on to someone else, and somebody's going to do the honors and move on to someone else. So I wonder how today's audience, you know, I don't know how you're exposed to it, but I got a lot of feedback, Lance, on the Daniel Bryan buildup in WWE, where people just couldn't wait. Every week he should have got his moment. Every week, and then he didn't, they were angry. They were frustrated. And I just thought that it was kind of funny, and I would answer tweets and emails from my website and so forth. Well, what would you do, JR? Well, you know, what I would do, his moment would come, all right. You need to understand, Daniel Bryan's moment is going to come. If you really are going to plan it right, his moment will come at WrestleMania. Why would you want to come any earlier? Why would you want to come on a random Monday Night Raw? Why wouldn't you want it to be at WrestleMania? And sure enough, that's what happened. But I think a lot of people got very, impatient. And then they started doubting that Daniel Bryan was going to get his just due. And I don't know where did you stand on that storyline?
They came close to holding off too long for me. I was certainly more patient than most, because I felt it was coming, but I was getting to the point where I was starting to get impatient. And you're so right. It's reading the masses and deciding, you know, whether you have to turn up the heat or turn it down a little bit.
Yep.
Because you do want it to boil in time for dinner. And that's your, again, Vince McMahon or Triple H or whoever the man in charge is now. I guess it's always going to be Vince. As long as his heart's beating, yep. he'll have the final say, and that's his job. He has to decide when you pull that trigger. And I think, unfortunately, it's probably the vocal minority, at least I hope so, that they want to criticize. They want to point out that they know better. And instead of allowing the story to play out for a little while before they tell us how bad it's written and how they would have done it better. Sometimes it's best to let things play out and see where they're going. And maybe even boo the heels for their actions rather than the writers for telling them what to do would might make the product more enjoyable to watch.
Did you ever work with Daniel Bryan?
I did. I had a Ring of Honor world title match in 2006, I believe.
Wow.
A year after I left WWE. It was the same night as the Hall of Fame in Chicago, before WrestleMania. So it was April 1st or 2nd. And we went, I think, 27 minutes. And it was one of my best matches, if I do say so myself.
Oh, good. No, I thought, hey, you two guys, as fundamentally sound as both of you are and as unselfish, which fans need to understand, that's a major facet to the success of a wrestling match, is that not only do the talents need to have a viable skill set, but they both have to have be unselfish and be giving, so the match has got some balance. And so knowing you guys as I do, I would think nothing less than it would be pretty damn stellar.
Yeah, it was. I had a lot of respect for him. Again, even back then, he was tremendous. Gabe Sapolsky was the booker at the time, and apart from saying who we wanted up, he says, I think you two guys can decide what you think is best. I'd like you to put in at least 20 minutes, and we put in just about 30. And he was using a submission finish at the time as well as a pinfall, and we actually went out there not sure which one we were going to do. We weren't sure, and it was Daniel Bryan's call at first. He was obviously retaining the Ring of Honor title. I was just in for the one show. And he didn't think the crowd would want to see me tap. He says, I'd rather pin you. I don't think the crowd wants to see you tap. And he had a submission that he could roll into a pin. And I told him, I said, why don't we just get out there and see how it feels at the time?
There you go.
I said, you hook me in that. We'll read the crowd. I said, if I think I feel that I should tap, I'll tap. If you think I should tap, let me know. I said, if not, roll me and pin me, and we'll just see what the crowd does.
Yeah, that's beautiful. That's artwork right there. I remember one time back in the 70s, Lance, I refereed a match in Tulsa, believe it or not, with Dory Jr. and Harley Race. And they didn't want to do the obligatory 60-minute Broadway because somebody had kind of done a little bit of research and found out that the last X number of times that the NWA champion was in Tulsa, that he went to an hour Broadway. So they said, let's change it up a little bit. And I can't even remember who the champion was. I think it was Dory. Pretty sure it was Dory. So, but nonetheless, I'm the referee, and Harley says, I go in their dressing room, Harley's smoking a Marlboro, and Junior's, you know, just sitting there looking at his boots. It's just another day at the office, and Harley says, get down on the floor and show me how you count. So I got down on the floor, not knowing if it was a rib or not, if he was going to stomp on me or slap me in the back or whatever. But I counted to three. He says, do you count that way every time? And I said, yes, sir. He said, okay, make sure you count that way every time. And I said, is there anything else I need to know? He said, yeah, if you see me cheat, break it. If you don't catch me, you can't break it. Call what you see and see what you call. I said, okay. So I left the room not even knowing the finish. I didn't know who was going to go over. I didn't know if we were going to have a new champion or what. So I'll go Broadway. And they went inside 55 minutes. And finally, Dory caught Harley with a maybe an inside cradle or something along those lines. But they had a great match. And Lance, I'll tell you, this is the truth. In that referee in that match, I never heard him call a spot. And I'm in the ring with him. So you can imagine how it was to the front row people. They're thinking they're seeing the real deal. So it was just like your match with Daniel Bryant. You go feel it. You go execute. You dictate to the audience. It was just or let the audience dictate to you. And it was a night I'll never forget. One of those memorable bucket list nights I still think about. All these, it's been 40 years. 40 years ago. That's a long time to remember one match that you didn't even broadcast.
It is, but sometimes those are the best ones.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They were artists, man. They were Rembrandts. They had just had a different canvas than everybody else, but they were Rembrandts without question. Hey, what did you think of CM Punk's somewhat abrupt departure from WWE, and do you think he's done with wrestling?
I find it hard to believe he's done. Just that he's still so young. You know, he's got, I think he's mid-30s. So there's, you know, there's a decade in him physically that might still be able to go. Whether he takes a break for 6 months, 2 years, 5 years, I think he'll be back at some point. I don't like passing too much judgment on how he left because I wasn't there.
Oh, yeah, me neither.
But I think at the end of the day, if you're emotionally or mentally not in it, it's best to get out.
Yeah.
If you could have given them a bit more notice than I'm leaving and walking out the door, I think that's the professional way to go, regardless how you feel. But, again, if you don't know what the conversation was, you can't pass judgment. I think he's missed. I think if he's gone for a year and comes back, he will be a huge asset. And usually cooler heads prevail in the long run. If there's some business to be made, I think both sides will eventually make it. But, again, if you hit that wall and your body or your mind just isn't in it, you're probably a danger to yourself anyway.
Yeah, I agree. I think that he's just – sometimes he just hits a wall. Everybody's wired differently. You know, people say, well, have you seen this ever happen before? Well, you know, it doesn't matter if you've seen it before because everybody – you're human. You got unique DNA. Everybody's wired differently. And he was a very emotionally invested guy. You know, he came up the hard way, you know, the indies and the small venues and little money. And hey, you're not going to make it because you're not big enough. You're not this enough or whatever enough. So he always had kind of a chip on his shoulder, which I thought played well for him, quite frankly, on TV. But we don't know what's going on. And I tell people this all the time. They said, well, he deserves us a farewell. And we deserve a farewell. What? I don't get that. This is just me. You know, for him to come back out and not have a match and go out and say, "Hey, it's been great. Thank you all very much. I'm leaving." I don't know, Lance. I have mixed emotions about that theory that some fans have.
Yeah, I think it's great if that can happen, but I have a problem with anyone owing anybody, to be honest.
Yeah.
Be it promoter, be it wrestler, be it fan. You know, there's promoters that have given me a really great break, but they did it because they needed talent that worked hard. And I worked hard and delivered. So while I am grateful to that promoter, I don't think I owe him, and I don't think he owes me. And while I'm grateful to the fans that bought tickets, bought a T-shirt, showed up, ordered a pay-per-view, and watched me wrestle, the night you put your money down, I worked my butt off for you. That was our arrangement. And as long as I give you my 100% the night you bought my ticket, I don't owe you more years of my life, and you don't owe me more money. If there is the opportunity for me to say thank you and be pleasant to you, and you can be pleasant to me, I think that's fantastic. But at the end of the day, again, Paul Heyman, Jim Cornette gave me breaks because they needed talent, and I worked hard for them.
Right, exactly.
And when, you know, you were technically the guy that hired me in WWE, and I treated you with respect, and I busted my butt for you.
You sure did. Yeah, you sure did. And, you know, Lance, the thing about this podcast I've been doing for the last several weeks is that it gives me the opportunity to say, well, how do you get these guests? You know, you've had some really good guests, and shows have been kind of, you know, pretty cool, and so forth and so on. I say, you know, it's an outlet for me to reconnect with people that I like. And I don't know when the last time you and I had a substantive conversation, but it's been a long, long time. So it's good to be able to reconnect even in this format. So that's I'm really glad you took time to be with us here today.
Oh, I was happy to. I've listened to, I think I've missed one. I haven't listened to the Michelle Beadle podcast yet, but I'm pretty up to date.
Oh, good, good.
I enjoy listening to them.
Appreciate it, appreciate it. Hey, you know, I look back and get asked this a lot, and I think it's just it was a missed opportunity, not preconditioning your answer, trying to, just because I'm just telling you how I feel, just to kind of get the ball rolling. I thought that the invasion angle that we did in WWE when WCW came in, I thought in hindsight that there was a lot more juice in the fruit than we got out of it. We could have got more out of it. What was your thoughts on that whole process?
Yeah, I thought it could have been extended, done longer. I think there was a lot of business aspects that sort of influenced the direction, and I can understand some of that. But I don't remember the actual buy rate, but I know the Invasion pay-per-view
did well.
Did really well.
Yeah.
And I think that was a sign that there was more fruit on the tree.
Yep.
And it seemed to wrap up shortly thereafter. And it was disappointing because it felt like it should have been bigger. Because, I was a kid, you know, growing up watching WCW and WWF at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And then being someone who ended up going to WCW, and actually being technically the first WCW guy on WWE television with the Invasion Superkick, it felt monumental somewhat. The simulcast Raw Nitro felt like history.
Yeah.
And it felt like there could have been more there, but unfortunately it didn't. We got something out of it. We could have gotten more, I think.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, it was just, I think politics, egos, agendas got in the way of making more money, in my view. I thought that, and you know, people say, well, you didn't have all the right players. Well, you know, some of those guys that we didn't get from WCW, it's not like that you can go put a gun to their temple and you know, and point them in the direction of WWE and say, okay, there's your next stop. Hey, they were getting guaranteed money from Time Warner, and some of them were getting significant money from Time Warner, Lance, and they had a chance to sit home and get those checks every week, and that's what they did. They didn't want to come. They wanted to, they're going to play that whole contract thing out, and that's why we didn't get a lot of the guys. We didn't get the whole WCW team. But with that said, I think that the team we got, we could have done better with if we had been smarter and we'd done a better job of big picture planning, which was always seemingly a trait to WWE. And Vince, in my view, over the years. And for some reason, it just didn't work out with that invasion angle. And I don't know exactly the reasons, other than Was it political? Was it egocentric? Was it lack? Was it short-term planning? Was it just a human error? I don't know, but something was missing on that deal. We should have gotten more out of it.
I think some of it might have been that, and again, I wasn't in WCW for the majority of the war. We were pretty much losing pretty handily by the time I got to WCW. But I think when there was those couple years of really heated hatred and rivalry, where it was a fight for survival, I sensed that when we got to WWE, there was a lot of people in WWE, and I don't blame them, that felt, we fought to the death, we won, now why are we bringing the losers over and giving them our spots?
Yeah, crazy.
And I understand the mentality, but there is a point that you've got to realize, well, we're all on the same team now.
Yeah.
How do we maximize profits?
Boy, I tell you what, as the head of talent relations at that time, you talk about having I need to be Dr. Phil instead of JR, because there was a lot of psychology and a lot of counseling and a lot of, you know, walking somebody off the ledge or reassuring, you know. The business in general, as you well know, is wrought with insecurity and paranoia by a lot of people. And I think it's that way in professional sports in general and in the entertainment business, because you're only as good as your last game. You're only as good as your last role. So a lot of people are so insecure, and here comes all these guys, and some of them are hungry, some of them aren't, some of them are indecisive. But, it was a challenging time for me in my role at that point in time with all those guys, new guys coming into the locker room. So it was crazy. It was a crazy time. What was it like being in the Un-Americans? I get a kick out of it, and because two of the nicest guys in the whole world were you and William Regal, Steve Regal, Darren Matthews, and in my view, two of the nicest guys I've ever met in the business, my 40 years, were you two guys. And it's just funny how the casting was, where you got these two, you know, villainous individuals, because they just happen that they're not born or from America. And really, that's all that made you a villain. You just weren't American. So, hence, Un-Americans.
Yes, although we enjoyed being scoundrels, he and I.
You're a good one, too.
It was, again, it started with Christian and I, and then we added Test, and then William Regal came along, and then we splintered off, and it just became William Regal and I.
Yeah.
And it was really fun when we first started, because it was a Vince pet project somewhat, and he actually wrote some of our first promos. And thankfully, we were given the free rein to at least alter them and reword them, as long as we kept the gist of them. So they put some good steam on us at the beginning, and when we started with Christian, you know, I got to work with Hulk Hogan and Edge, which was just amazing. And actually, one great story, it was probably, you always hear the story about people, you know, that always get nervous before their matches, and you'll hear the stories, you know, when I don't get nervous, that's when I know I need to hang up the boots. I almost never got nervous. I don't know what it was. I had the confidence in my ability that this is what I do for a living. I'm good at it. I'm going to go out and I'm going to go to work. And it was probably the most nervous I've ever been in my life. It was backstage with Vince. And it was my first big, heated, un-American promo. The what right did you have in Vietnam? And really hitting some heavy stuff.
Yeah.
And I knew Vince wrote it. And I'm backstage going through it in my head, trying to get it. And Vince walks up and says, "You got that promo down, Pally?" And I didn't, but I'm not going to tell him that. So I'm like, "Of course I do. Yes, no problem, sir." And he's like, "All right, come with me." And he drags me into a small little room that's not much bigger than a large bathroom. And he pulls up his chair and sits right in front of me, about 2 feet right in front of me, and looks at me and says, "Deliver it like you're going to deliver it out there. Go."
Wow.
And he's, you know, 2 feet from me. There's Vince McMahon. And I was so nervous, and it's like, well, I got to hit this thing out of the park or I'm going to strike out, but I'm going down swinging. And I delivered it to him as best I could, and he was happy with it. There was one word. He says, "Punch this a little bit stronger. I think there's more power to this," whatever the word was. I don't recall now.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, "But good job." And he got up and left, and I sat down in the chair he was in and just, "Oh, my goodness. Don't do that to me again."
Yeah. Yeah, he's a complex, unique guy, no doubt about it, but and great vision. And it's good that, you know, he knew your strengths and weaknesses, and he knew how important the interview was. So, you know, it's good judgment. You know, hey, run it by me and see how you do. And I guarantee you, Lance, that gave you a lot of confidence. It had to.
Oh, yeah, once I went out there, it's like, if I can do this in front of Vince and he's happy with it, I'm going to hit it out of the park here for sure in front of the people.
I never felt so sorry for you guys, you and Regal. And he and I, when I was still employed by WWE and primarily working in NXT, I would go down and do TV, and I'd occasionally sit in on a match, or I'd produce the announcers or what have you. And but he would Regal and I would go to lunch. That was our little routine. And we went to I think Moe's because they had grass fed beef and he could eat gluten free and all these things. And actually, I ate better when I was with him than I did on my own, and got a little bit of a nutritional education from him because he's completely gluten free and drug and alcohol free and all these things. So we'd go to Moe's every Wednesday or Thursday, whatever it was, Thursdays I think it was, and do the TV. And I said, so and we'd bring, occasionally we'd laugh about the match that's, I use that term loosely, Lawler and me against you and Regal in Oklahoma City. It was December. It was a December match because the OU pep band was there because, you know, me being the Oklahoma guy and we had this angle and all this other crap. I felt so bad because, A, I got zero skills, zero, maybe less than zero. And here's two of the most talented in-ring workers that I knew, in you and Regal, having to put us over. Now, Lawler, I get. Lawler's a good worker. But me? You kidding? And, of course, I got the – because we're in Oklahoma City, it was one of the few times in my life that I came out of Oklahoma City in one piece. But I felt – and you guys did that like pros. You took care of us. You didn't potato anybody. You didn't stiff anybody. You didn't hurt me. And of course, the angle was set up for the Dudleys to come in and shoot the angle of the Un-Americans because it looked like you were going to disengage Lawler and to get your hands on me, which is going to be easy pickings. And so then here come the Dudleys, and chaos ensued, and the good guys won, and we lived happily ever after. So I've always felt that was a cool time. And I think I had too much fun that night celebrating because Vince says, well, I'll fix this celebration. This won't ever happen again when JR comes to Oklahoma City. We'll show him, by golly. But you guys are total pros, man, total pros. And I used to remind you what Regal, you know, about that. I said, well, you know, I do hold a victory over you. He just kind of looked at me with a little smile he has, like, you know, it could have been over so quickly. Because, you know, both you guys are tough guys. But, you know, Regal's got that reputation for being a little bit evil. You know, that mean streak, you know.
But I remember that night, and it was a lot of fun. I remember, too, you actually at one point pulled me aside and apologized for us having to be in the ring with you.
Well, I did feel bad.
And I don't know if you recall, but I remember pointing out that it was very similar to when they send me down to do guest commentary.
Yeah.
It's like, you do your best when I'm down there to not make me look like an idiot. I'll do the best here with you.
Yeah.
And that's one thing that, again, I so enjoyed my team with William Regal because we're both what I like to call journeyman wrestlers that have, you know, worked around the world and done the job. And there was never a moment ever that when I was teaming with William Regal that I didn't think both of our goals were exactly the same.
Right.
And that was achieving the best match and delivering exactly what the agents or Vince or whoever else wanted out of us.
Yeah.
I never felt he was trying to outshine me or that we were trying to, you know, sneakily outshine our opponent. It was just this trust and belief that we're out here to do the job. And by golly, we're going to do the best job. And I think, too, that my strengths were his weaknesses and vice versa, in that, again, I was certainly more athletic and mobile than he was.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, his facial expressions and his personal intensity is just off the charts.
Unbelievable.
And so we complement each other really well. And that when we were putting matches together or just out there working, if it was something that we thought I would do better than him, then I did it. If it was something that we thought he would be better suited for, he did it.
Right.
It really was we're the two tools in this team, and whichever tool fits the job is what's going to do it because we're getting this job done.
Exactly. I'll hit you with a variety of questions here that are of interest to me. I have some Twitter questions. Was Benoit already in the business when you and Chris broke in 90?
Oh, yeah. He was in Japan working as...
Pegasus Kid?
Pegasus Kid at the time, yeah.
Yeah. What was your relationship with him? And obviously, I know you were probably as shocked as the rest of us when the last weekend of his life, but what was your relationship with him? Because, you know, as I've talked to MVP recently, who traveled with him a lot and learned some things about Chris I didn't know. And I always got along great with Chris. I hired him. I brought him in, and I worked through his neck injury, where he was off a year. But what was your relationship like with him? And there, and here's why I asked the question. And maybe it's being, maybe I'm being nearsighted. You're both from Alberta. Him from Edmonton, right? You from Calgary. So I just figured you would maybe understand him better than some. Maybe you crossed paths more with him. I didn't know. But and not to try to, just to look back, what was your observations other than the obvious of that whole situation? Did you have a theory on it or a thought process that you had on that Benoit deal?
I didn't know him as well as people thought. We always just missed each other in every promotion. That when he was in ECW, he left when I got there. He left WCW just when I got there. Really, when I came into WWE, he was just going off with the neck injury. When he got back, there was a brand split, and we were on different brands.
Wow.
We really didn't cross paths much at all. I really didn't get to know him too much until, actually, I had left WWE. When I first started opening up my school, he went so far out of his way, if there's anything I can do to help, because he was always so much for helping the business and giving back to the business. And he helped me find my ring and helped get me started with that. So we really started a online relationship via email and text afterwards. We had talked whenever we were on the same shows because we had mutual friends with, you know, Jericho and Eddie and so forth. So we were friendly and got along, but we didn't spend a lot of time together. But he was, again, so helpful with getting me started and so nice to deal with. I was as shocked as everybody. I don't think there is an answer.
No, I agree.
I think there was, 10 different pieces that fed into making a horrible puzzle. Again, whether it be concussions, whether it be some degree of drug use, be it antidepressants or steroids, whether it be just emotional anxiety with family life, there's no way to tell. It was the most horrible, weekend that you could ever possibly imagine, and I don't think anyone will ever come to grips with it.
I agree. You think he belongs in the Hall of Fame in WWE?
I'm one of the ones that say no.
Yeah, me too.
I just think that the real-life events trump the wrestling business, and I don't see how WWE can get away with honoring him and not getting crucified.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
It's obviously his career contributions and what he did in the business are worthy of being in the Hall of Fame, but coming out and honoring and celebrating a man after what happened that weekend, I don't see how it can be done.
I mentioned MVP on this podcast that if there was a way that we could reach out to Chris with one call and say, hey, look, what do you think about going to the WWE Hall of Fame under the circumstances that you left this earth? He would say, don't do it, because it would be a huge distraction to all those others that were going in the same class. The story would be about the last weekend of his life, not about his career. And I believe that. I'm with you. I just don't think that he will ever be in the Hall of Fame, nor should he be, and I don't think he'd want to be. That's just my opinion. So what did you do you think, I've written about this, and I really be interested in your thoughts, even though you were a stereotypical 80s and the territory era baby face, your look and your body type, your athleticism, your ability to sell, not the biggest dog in the hunt, but not a little guy. But do you think that it's harder today in our business to be a heel than it's ever been before?
I think so. I think it's harder to get genuine heat nowadays. Because I think if you're really good at being a heel, fans are smart enough to appreciate it. And I think that is really hard. But I think generally now, I think getting a genuine emotion, be it a top babyface or a top heel, I think is hard. That coming out of the closet so much as we did, and constantly reminding people, sometimes even while you're watching the show, that it's a show, it's harder to get a genuine emotional reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And those who seem to get it, again, Daniel Bryan seems to have managed to develop a genuine connection with the people. And again, I think Sami Zayn does it quite well in NXT. When you do make that connection, it's so valuable. And if you can manage to get heat and be a top heel, it's really hard. I think utilizing managers is probably more important today than ever before, because you can have someone like Paul Heyman or Dutch, Zeb Coulter,
mm-hmm.
that can go out there and say despicable things and be a despicable person, but he's not going to deliver you that great match that you appreciate.
All right, yeah.
And I think using them can help get that reaction. And oddly enough, in a way, Don Marie in ECW really helped me find a personality end that generated some emotion.
Yeah, she did. She was underrated, no doubt.
Yeah, I had the physical pieces, and I needed to find myself as a performer, and I needed a personality, and she really helped me find that.
She had a little sizzle to your act, no doubt about it. You know, I agree with that. What do you think about the booking strategy or the creative positioning of Bray Wyatt? Because I find it very fascinating. You know, I happen to like Bray Wyatt as a person. I knew his grandfather. Of course, knew his dad, still do, very well. Third generation kid, all those good things. But I am, I don't know if he's fish or fowl.
Yeah, I'm not as big on him. And again, I like the guy, I know the guy, I've worked with him in NXT before. I'm not as much of a fan or I don't hate him as much, if you will, as a villain that I did when he first debuted. The singing and some of that presentation confuses me.
Mm-hmm.
I was always told that as a heel, if the crowd starts getting behind you, that's something you need to nip in the bud, unless you're planning on jumping fences.
Right.
And to me, it's like you want to try to steer all of that kind of reaction to your opponent when you're a heel, which is one of the reasons why I enjoyed being a heel so much once I finally turned. I found it hard being selfish enough as a babyface. I was far more comfortable giving than taking, and that's, to me, more important as in the heel side. And I think at times, WWE and everyone, that we're getting to the point where, you know, any big reaction's a good reaction, and, well, there may be some truth to that. I don't think that is a universal statement.
I agree.
That still at the roots, I want to see a match for conflict, and I'm so much more invested when I'm rooting for one side or the other.
Well, it's like a you know, the Americans, people in America in general, not all, but in general, are not major hockey fans. In the hockey towns, they are, when they're winning, but amateur-wise. And I found it amazing a couple of years ago when the USA found themselves in the finals of this tournament with the Canadians. And, man, every bar, every sports bar, restaurant, everybody had it on TV. It was a big deal because this nationalism angle, the nationalistic angle of USA versus Canada. I thought about Brett and, you know, the USA versus Canada thing back in the day and all that stuff. You know, I think that there's got to be an emotional attachment where someone is declaratively a heel or a babyface to some degree. I will admit, and I think that's true, that there are a lot of heel fans nowadays. Whatever's caused that's whatever's caused it, but I think there's a lot of heel fans nowadays without question. So, to say that It doesn't matter if you're a heel or babyface, just in my opinion, Lance, as long as you're a star. I don't see how you move forward successfully without having declaratively a heel or babyface, a home team or a visitor, the good guys and the bad guys. There's got to be some line of demarcation there, in my opinion. Or am I too old school to look at it in a newer way?
No, I'm on the same page with you. I think you got to have a dog in the hunt. And I think where several people got wrong, in my opinion, in their definition, and it started with Steve Austin, because he wasn't your stereotypical good guy. But anyone that thinks he wasn't a babyface is a fool.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
And I think at Austin, and again, Eddie Guerrero did it with the lying, cheating, and stealing, the definition of what a babyface was changed. You didn't have to clean break and shake hands and kiss babies to be a babyface anymore because they wanted a harder-edged guy. But make no mistakes about it, when Eddie was lying, cheating, and stealing, he was a babyface. And when Steve Austin was flipping people off, he was a babyface.
Yep.
And, you know, you knew what dog was in the hunt, and it's like everyone was behind those guys. Now, they weren't your stereotypical babyface.
Right.
And again, even Bob Backlund, when he made his return, he was doing babyface antics from his generation, but the crowd didn't like it. So he was the heel.
Right.
And it's about the emotional response, and the definition and the means by which you get that response may have changed, but I still want to have someone that I want to get behind and can relate to. And I think that's never going to go away in this industry, and I think that's always going to be the best money draw.
Which is a good segue to my next question. What did you think of The Undertaker streak ending at WrestleMania 30? Were you for it? Were you against it? Do you understand it later now? Do you feel better about it? What's your thoughts on that? Because I still get every day something on Twitter or email about The Undertaker streak. It had deeper roots, I think, than a lot of people realized. It was a significant part of WrestleMania.
Yeah, I certainly would have been completely happy and content for him to retire undefeated. But I did also, and I think you did read it once, I think I sent it to you and Steve when you were debating it on your show the one time, I sent a booking scenario I had for a means by which to beat the streak. And it had to have been done a little more long-term, and I think it would have added more emotion to each WrestleMania with the streak. And for those who didn't read the article, it was doing the interview with Undertaker asking if he ever thought the streak would end and have him say yes, because I will defend it until it does. I'm not going to retire at 26-0 and wonder if I could have went 27. So then you've got the fans emotionally realizing that this is actually going to happen someday.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, well, by golly, I want to be there when it happens. And then every near fall that happens, you're going to wonder, is this the time? Is this the time? And I think with that, you'd be better prepared, and you wouldn't have the shock that seems to be the consensus, that everybody was just in such disbelief that it was just sort of a silent, it's like, what just happened?
Yeah, yeah. It was shocking, man. I was watching it back at the WWE hotel in New Orleans because I was writing a piece for Fox on WrestleMania, so I didn't need to be. I need to be where I could watch the show and hear it, and to write my piece as I was, you know, writing as the matches progressed, kind of like you would covering a hockey game. You just kind of period by period, and the highlights of what was going on. So I was shocked. I thought, wait a minute, what happened? You know, I can't believe that just occurred. And, you know, Shawn Michaels is on here a few weeks ago, and he said, you know, Vince talked Undertaker into it about four hours before the show. Now, Vince may have had his mind made up before show day. I don't know. But I know Undertaker was not aware that the finish was going to go down as it was until approximately 4 hours before showtime. And I don't know if that's strange or what, but it was a shocking finish. They got a lot of people talking about it, and to learn more, they went to the WWE Network.
And I think the important thing for everyone to remember is it doesn't change Undertaker's legacy one bit. His contributions to this business, his respect and stature in this business, are every bit what they were whether he was going to win or lose.
Yep, I agree.
He's, you know, top shelf Hall of Fame, done things that no one else could have done. And, you know, there is something to, you know, going out in your last match on your back. You know, Austin did it for Rock. Rock may have done it for Cena. And Taker may have done it for Brock Lesnar. Nothing but respect to the man, and he's Hall of Fame bound without a shadow of a doubt.
Yeah, he kind of, you know, he's he may have replaced Andre as the biggest iconic figure over long term as anybody in WWE. It's arguable. I mean, Andre was Andre, the first giant, and traveled the world, all those things. But if you look at Undertaker's contributions to WWE over the long haul, it's hard to say that anyone, including Hogan, including Austin, including Shawn Michaels, Triple H, anybody, has contributed more longer in WWE than The Undertaker.
And I think also, too, just his respect as being the boss.
Yeah.
When he was in the locker room, there wasn't a man in there that didn't respect him.
That's right. That's right. Hey, real quick on some of these questions, I want to make sure that some of my Twitter people don't get too pissed off. What is an offbeat shenanigan?
I have absolutely no idea.
All right, good. We'll move on. Somebody asked to ask you that. What is? Ask Lance what an offbeat shenanigan is. Okay, we did, folks. He didn't know. Anyone from the 60s or 70s or even before or after that you didn't wrestle that you would have liked to have wrestled?
I wouldn't go back that far because I wasn't a fan back then. But actually, one guy I would have loved to have wrestled is Nick Bockwinkel.
Mm-hmm.
I met him a couple of times, and he was a classy gentleman and a phenomenal worker. Brett and Sean are two of the standouts, as is Steamboat, from the guys I watched as a fan that I unfortunately never had the opportunity to work with that really stand out. And Bobby Eaton, too. I was such a huge Bobby Eaton fan.
Yeah, great. So underrated, without question. Another question from Twitter, and I don't get this one. I don't know the backstory, so I'm not setting you up. I just don't know. But I had a lot of questions about you working with Jerry Lynn and not bumping. What the heck's that?
In ECW, because that was a, you know, crazed territory where guys were killing themselves often, Jerry Lynn and I would go out there and have wrestling matches. And there was a point where we had a really good match, and the RF video guys were videotaping. It's like, man, that was incredible. And I said, you know, we only took 4 bumps. And they're like, what? No way. And I'm like, yeah, because it's not just about the moves. And it got to the point where I started thinking, you know, we could probably cut a few of those out and no one would notice. And we ended up doing a match where we had designed it around having one bump only, like a flat back. We'd take some rolls, we'd take some head scissors and
yeah,
so forth. But as
great.
Far as flat back landing on the mat thud, we were just going to have one each. It was at the same time, just to see if we could do it and have the crowd think we were still having, and we were, having really good, hard-working matches. And we went out there, and just as the spot was getting into where we'd take a bump, there was a glitch. And rather than messing it up, I cut it off, and we went somewhere else. And at the end of the match, you come back, and everybody's like, oh, great match. And I'm like, we didn't take a single bump.
Wow.
And everybody was like, no way. And we ended up doing a couple of them like that. You know, we'd brawl, we'd fight, we'd do some mat wrestling first, but we didn't actually ever pick each other up and bump us on the mat.
Right.
And we did 2 or 3 of them in ECW.
Somebody's followed the storyline pretty good on that deal. So any difference, you saw major differences in working with Cornette and Heyman? Because I used to tell them both in front of each other, and it would aggravate the hell out of them, that you guys are so much alike. Just one of you's from south of the Mason-Dixon line, and the other's from the northeast. But you guys just have different accents, but you're so much alike. Started out as photographers, lifelong fans. Neither one of them athletic bone in their body, but they both got brilliant minds. But they didn't want to hear it. They didn't want to hear it. But So what was what's the biggest difference in the two guys?
They're really just different sides of the absolute same coin.
I agree.
I think Paul is a little more willing to push the envelope, and Jim Cornette's a little more traditional. And I think part of that, too, is the South versus the North, in that Cornette likes his baby faces to be baby faces and his heels to be heels, where Paul's willing to change the definition more.
Mm-hmm.
But they are so much alike.
They are.
And back in the day, they both had a diet that would choke a goat.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think Jim Cornette's got the better punch, though.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. That's good. Yeah, I think they're both brilliant guys, and I broadcast with both of them. I saw them both manage. You know, they're both Hall of Fame level guys in my estimation. Final question here, kind of gets off the wrestling track. For a while, it seemed like you were not a UFC fan, and then now it seems like you're a little bit more into it. What changed your mind, if I'm even accurate, from going from a lukewarm fan to a seemingly more educated USC fan?
I was a big fan from the get-go. Oh. And followed it quite a while. I got turned off and gave up on it completely for a year or two, thanks to Chael Sonnen, actually. I was very irate after getting talked into buying the Sonnen Silva fight and then having him fail a drug test afterwards. And there was two or three other very questionable commission rulings on drug use, and I'm, again, as anti-drug as you're ever going to get, and I got soured on UFC and what they did and how they dealt with steroids in their sport. So I got away from it, and the main reason I came back was my daughter. My oldest daughter is an MMA fan, and she wanted to start watching the shows, and she wanted to watch them with me. And there was a few changed rulings, and again, they've gotten rid of TRT now in the Nevada State Athletic Commission.
Mm-hmm.
They've cracked down somewhat on their drug testing. It still has a ways to go, as does every sport. But they did enough to pacify me in that regard, and then the desire to have something in common that I can spend time with my oldest daughter was a big motivating factor.
Interesting. Family deal. Good deal. That's good. Lance, look, I really appreciate you being with us, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. We've covered a lot of topics and a lot of subjects. I can see us doing this again one of these days. And Lance, again, thank you. Good luck on your school. And if there's anything I can ever do for you, you know how to get a hold of me. I'm always ready, willing, and able to help you any way that I can. You're a good man, and the kids are lucky that they're there.
Greatly appreciate it, my friend. All the best, and keep up the good work on the podcast.
Okay, pal. See you, Lance.
Take care. Bye.